Hello and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security, this time episode 30. Can you believe we're up to 30, Chow? I mean, that's amazing.
Well, that's amazing, and it's a very long time. With everything that's been happening, it doesn't feel that long, but wow, 30.
Yeah, there's no shortage of topics here. I remember we started like every other week?
Because,
you know, that's what it was. But there's just so much to talk about that I don't think it's really sustainable just talking every other week, unless every other week is a 2 or 3 hour episode or something. But anyway.
We actually should check. It should be closer about now that we're celebrating the first anniversary of the podcast.
You know, I should check that out, actually. I forgot when we started this. It just kind of seems like we've always had it, but, you know, everything has a beginning at some point. So that's a good point. It's probably, hopefully it hasn't passed.
Yeah, hopefully it hasn't passed. I know the cake is a lie, but still, we should deserve cake. We should get some cake to celebrate the first anniversary.
Any cake or any excuse for cake is a good thing. So... in today's episode, I wanted to kind of do another foundational episode, but this one is going to be focused on tools that we can use. And I'm not going to say over and over again every time I mention a tool that it's not going to make you 100% safe. Obviously, we've said that enough. And if you've heard previous episodes, you already know that. If this is the first episode you're jumping into, and well, now you know that no one tool is going to do that for you. But it's a great idea to have, at least some tools that you can use that we use or that we've recommended. Also, obviously, we're not going to give you every single tool you can use. This isn't an extensive list. It's in semi-random, but we could do another episode and talk more about this. That doesn't mean this is the only one. And the other disclaimer I'm going to give everyone before we start is, even though we're giving you a list of tools, exercise caution before you use any of them. Make sure you have permission to use them, because if you are not the person that manages the network or you're level of management in your company isn't high enough, you could get in trouble by running some tools, because whoever is monitoring the network, if that's not you, or if someone also monitors it, they could see the traffic as an intrusion attempt in and of itself. So just exercise caution. We're not responsible if you blow your servers up or if you get fired. If you don't let somebody know, just let somebody know ahead of time that you want to try these tools before you do. But anyway, the point here is we have a list. There's a list of things, and these are things in a more general sense that'll either help you prevent problems, recover from problems, scan for problems, and things of that nature.
Yeah. And again, it's a list of things that will make your life a bit easier if you're into this side of the business.
Yep.
Not the end all be all of all the lists. Anybody can find fault in any list that we could create. So. Yeah, the internet being good, what the internet is, we know that you'll complain that we're either missing tool so-and-so or that we shouldn't have included the tool so-and-so, but it comes with the podcast.
When it comes to content creation in general, that's how it goes, right? But the thing is, we try our best, and ultimately, the way I look at it, is it possible that someone knows a much better tool that should have been on this list? Well, absolutely. Let us know, because that could actually inspire us to do an episode about it. So maybe that's a great thing if someone finds something we haven't covered, because there's no end to this podcast. I really don't see an end here, because I'll probably retire before we hear. I'm going to go over one of these right now, and then we'll just go on from there. And I'm going to mention these kind of together because of the purpose that I used them for recently, but you don't have to. I mean, they're not technically related. A lot of these tools that we'll mention in the Unix philosophy, they could be chained together to just like vulnerabilities can, we could chain together solutions. People that are trying to attack us can chain together their own solutions. I used air quotes. But the first of which is Nmap, which is a security scanning tool that I'm actually in the process of creating a video for that on the YouTube channel. I don't know when it's going to be out. Sometime this summer. I know that's vague, but it will happen. And Nmap can be used to, like I said, scan for things on the network, to do OS fingerprinting, but also ARPWatch, I'm going to mention as well. The scenario here is if you have something on your network and you're like, what is that? What is that device? I don't remember ever seeing that device before. Why is it on the network? I need some information about it. And, you know, Nmap could be used for other things too, like just finding out how many IP addresses on your network are used in a specific subnet if you wanted to. I mean, hopefully you have documentation where you wouldn't need to use Nmap for this, but if you don't, then you could scan a subnet and find out what IPs are live or at least responding. But going further, you could do OS fingerprinting to find out what operating system is being run on a device. In my case, there was an Android device that joined the network that I'm pretty sure I know who it was. Long story, this isn't a business thing. This isn't a Learn Linux TV thing. This is like a home network thing. But this is something that'll happen in the real world where you have a device. You want to know, okay, what is this? Did I set that up and forget about it? And that's what one of the things that Nmap can do is help give you clues about the device that might point you to the actual use case for it. And also ARPWatch, which is something I use in pfSense, and I know not everybody uses a pfSense firewall, so I'm assuming there has to be equivalent tools that do the same thing. But what ARPWatch allows me to do is get a notification anytime something new was added to the network. And I think that's probably even more important than Nmap. You need to know, you know, what's being used on your network, what's on your network. And if somebody plugs something in or joins a Wi-Fi SSID, and you need to know about this because any one of those devices could be a problem, and getting a notification about that will certainly help. So ARPWatch to get a notification, I guess, and Nmap, once you get a notification, to scan that device to find out more information about it. Obviously, you should block the device if you don't know what it is and get it off the network. But those are the first two tools that I wanted to mention. They're, again, not related, but they kind of are because they help you do the same thing, which is find out what the heck that weird thing is on the network that just joined.
I actually have another two tools that I use regularly related to networking as well on the Linux side of things. The first one is Netcat. It's pretty useful to send packets by hand. Basically, you want to send a specific packet to a specific destination, a specific port or whatever. Netcat will help you do exactly that. The other one is IP tables. I'm an old-time sysadmin. I used to create firewalls by hand through IP table scripts. So I really like the way IP tables was formatted and the way that it worked. I know there are some newfangled things that these kids today are using, but yeah, I still use IP tables wherever I can. I still install it on the systems I deploy.
And that's a great firewall, yeah.
And I really like the way that it's structured. And in addition to IP tables, I also use Xtables add-ons, which is a series of modules that you can add to IP tables that give you new matches and give you new targets for packets. And the specific one that I use a lot when I'm trying to block ports is the chaos target. It will respond with a different state each time that a port when a connection is attempted to a port that you're blocking. Rather than just dropping the packet, it can just not respond, or it can send a different packet back or something like that. And it will make, for example, scanning with Nmap really tricky because you won't get accurate responses.
Yep. That I didn't actually know about that myself. Obviously, I knew about IP tables, but yeah, beyond that. And another thing about IP tables, like some people, especially if you're just starting out, you could probably use like UFW. Not every distribution has that, which isn't itself a firewall. It's more of like a way to manage a firewall that simplifies things. I would prefer people learn IP tables and NF tables and those things because I feel like it's better to be more intimately familiar with the underlying technology. But if you're just starting out and you need a quick way to make it happen for now, there's always, I don't want to call it a wrapper or front end, but there's things like UFW. So the next two tools, I'm going to try to keep these quick because they are not security related. But I mentioned them because I feel like there's some of these issues, especially with hardware, the physical layer, if you will, that people run into, and it's hard for them to figure out, and they're not really sure what to do. It takes a really long time. And I think these tools can help save some time. Now, the first of these is iPerf 3, or just iPerf in general. You could use this to find out what your bandwidth is from point A to point B. Now, obviously, you could just use SCP, and you could just save an ISO file on one server and then just SCP it over to the other side and back. I mean, technically, you don't really need iPerf for this, but iPerf is a tool in and of itself, and What helped me recently, what I've discovered, and this is really weird, is I implemented 10 gig Ethernet, and I was getting barely 1 gig out of it. I'm like, what's going on? So in that situation, you could run iPerf between endpoints to find out which endpoint is actually slowing down your connection and why you're not getting the speed. Obviously, you're never going to get the full speed. That's just a pipe dream, the internet pipe, you know, pun there. I had to do that.
Pun intended. But,
pun intended, absolutely. Actually, at first it was not intended, but I rolled over it. But anyway,
I saw that glimmer in your eyes when it actually materialized.
So in my case, I actually had some help from Tom, which is a popular individual on the YouTube channel, where I had, you know, like I said, 10 gig wasn't working out. And I said I was going to keep this short, and I guess I lied. But anyway, what we ended up finding out was that there's some sort of bug in TrueNAS that where if you have jails running, it severely limits the capability of the network stack. And then by disabling jails, it magically worked. But iPerf led us to that scenario. So anyway, for more practical senses here, if you have a device in between endpoints that can't handle the bandwidth, you could pretty much isolate which device it is that's slowing down things. The other one that I was going to mention that's not security related, but is one of these things that I see very often is a use case for this very often is Memtest 86 or an equivalent memory test for physical hardware. Because in my experience, I don't know if it's been this way for you. You know me, I'm a Linux guy, right? But if another platform does something better than Linux, I will let everybody know because it's just the way it goes. In my personal experience, I found Windows to handle bad memory issues better than Linux. Linux, in my experience, seems to just go all kinds of haywire. It's not that Windows won't go haywire too. It just kind of seems to have fewer problems with bad memory. You should never have bad memory. But I've seen situations, for example, somebody's running a Windows server, then they move it over to Linux, and they're like, yeah, it's constantly locking up. Linux sucks. Well, you might have bad hardware. And Memtest 86 is something that I recommend people run on physical hardware every now and then just to make sure everything is fine. There's not really a big chance that this is going to be a problem for you, but if it is a problem for you, I find that physical memory problems are very hard to troubleshoot because the symptoms are almost always different. So that's why I wanted to bring this up.
In that category, I usually find diagnosing overheating problems or PSU problems to be a bit trickier because they don't always trigger at the same time. No. You might be replicating the issue and it doesn't happen, and then after a while it happens in a different situation. When it's memory, if you load up the system, you'll see something break. At least in my experience, I usually find it that way. What you mentioned about Windows dealing better with memory issues, my experience has not been that, but there is an advanced feature, if you can call it that way. You can actually tell Windows to limit the amount of memory that it uses. You might have 64 gigs on your machine, but you can limit it to using only 8, for example. And that does help you troubleshoot memory issues because it will eliminate some of the memory locations and memory addresses until you actually find the one that's giving you problems. And Linux also lets you do this. You can also block off blocks of memory for the system to ignore, and you can also do that on the Linux side as well. I don't know, Windows, whenever it has bad memory, it will spew out random BSODs or something like that, and you'll be left scratching your head because it will point out different things every single time. I don't know.
Yep, and
my personal experience hasn't been that it's better than Linux there.
So, yeah, that's interesting. I guess that's how it goes between administrators, right? Because our worldview is going to be, by our experiences. So for me, it's been the case that I've noticed Linux locking up more often. Obviously, Windows has a blue screen of death. That does happen, but I've also seen Windows machines that'll have these. I'm trying to remember what the error messages are because there's some predictability on Windows because there's a error message. I can't remember it, but if I see it again, I'll know right then and there that there's a memory problem when I see it. But I'll see, you know, because I deal with a lot of people from the YouTube channel that are switching to Linux, like especially on their laptop or desktop. And then they'll usually say, you know, well, Windows was fine. Linux is locking up. What's going on? And then a lot of the times I find that it's memory, believe it or not. So anyway, just test your RAM. I think that's probably a good thing to do. every now and then. Again, very small chance that you'll probably have a bad stick around, but it does happen.
Yeah.
So,
go ahead. And if you want to look at your hardware in detail, LSHW is your friend. It can give you a rundown of the hardware on your system and even show you what drivers are being loaded for each one. Look into the V flag there. You can actually repeat it lots of time for more information. It's a very powerful tool. There are equivalents for USB and PCI. So LS-PCI, LS-USB, they are your friends. Learn to use those.
Yep, absolutely. So I have a handful of tools to talk about that are all for the same purpose. I'm mentioning these for the same purpose because in the previous episode, we talked about the uncomfortable truth that even if you do a really great job with security and you get it, you know, you're paying attention to the RSS feeds, you know what's going on, you patch things when they need to be patched, you're installing the updated firmware, you're doing everything that we've talked about. The uncomfortable truth, though, is that you might still become a victim because there are some things out there, especially with the, you know, the situation we talked about in the previous episode, that, you know, people can still get in because it's really hard to detect some of these things. And if somebody does get in, despite all of your efforts to keep secure, what do you do? And the short answer is have a good and test a disaster recovery plan. Obviously, we hope you'll never have to use it. But if you do have to use that, take that plan out and actually execute it, that it needs to be tested and working. But as part of that, getting back up and running as quickly as you possibly can is important. It's also important, as we talked about, to understand, especially when you have to research how far someone got into your systems, you may not be able to get up and running quickly, despite, you know, your management team telling you that you need to have it done by the end of the day, which isn't going to happen. But that aside, we have several tools, or I've listed several tools, I'm sure you might have a few as well, that are going to help you just take the edge off of this process. Yeah. And just
in a note there, what you said about it taking some time, if you want to get to the bottom of it, we've actually had examples of that and we discussed them on the podcast.
Yep.
Remember that team that we talked about around Christmas, that they were going to take 3 weeks to get their systems back up online?
Yes, and that's actually what I was thinking about, yeah.
Yeah, and it's amazing. You hear an experienced IT team say that they're going to take 3 weeks to get systems back together. Yeah, it was a massive breach. They wanted to regain trust in their systems, and that takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. And the tools that we're going to mention here are pretty good help in that situation.
Yeah, I think that's and sometimes you're just a victim of assumptions. People assume that you're so smart that you'll have it done in a few minutes. Yeah. Because that's how smart you are. It's not that we're smart or not. It's just we have reality. So one of these is going to be either an internal or a private Git server. Okay, so GitT is something that I've gone over recently in a video, but it doesn't have to be that. There's GitLab, GitHub. I mean, they have private repositories. So one thing to keep in mind is just because you're putting something in Git, it doesn't mean that it's public. It can be, and it is if you don't tell it otherwise. But you generally won't want some repositories to be public. Also, even if it's private, you still don't want to add your passwords in there in clear text or your API keys. You should never do that. I don't care how private you make things, right? Never do that. But having a Git server for config, and I'm not talking about just being a software engineer, because if you're a software engineer, I mean, you probably know Git backwards and forwards. But what I don't think a lot of people understand is that Git is very useful for system administrators as well, because we can keep our Nagios configs in there, our Terraform, Packer, Ansible, Chef, Puppet, whatever it is, blueprints, diagrams, there in Git. So that way, well, maybe not so much diagrams, because we don't want to give someone a lot of information in case they break into it. But anyway, my point is, especially for configuration, you can store that in the Git server such that if you need to reload a server, you can pull that config and put it back in place. But another thing it allows you to do as well is, if a server stops working and you're wanting to know why, you could just go into the config directory. You could do a git status. It'll show you like what files were recently modified. And you can look at those files, find out who modified them or how they got modified. You could revert them back to a known working condition there. So that's just the beginning, though. get, and this, there's a reason why I mentioned this first among the tools in this group, is because the remaining tools are going to really be benefited by having a single place, private and secure place, to store your config files.
Just add something here. There, now that we're talking about Git, and it's somewhat related. It's not the same idea of getting the configuration on a central system, but it's a way for you to store the changes that are made in a system, so that if you make a change that breaks something, you can revert back to what existed. Etc/keeper. It's a really good program. It integrates with your package managers, and it works by creating a Git repository inside of your etc folder, so that any change that gets added to that folder will be added as a commit to Git, so that you can revert to previous versions if you need it. And it will do that automatically. You don't have to do anything. You install etc/keeper, you keep using your regular package manager, and it will take care of that. If you ever need to roll back a change that happens, you just Git and get back the commit from a day ago or from before that last change, and get stuff back running again. It has saved my bacon a couple of times.
And it might have inspired a video on the channel. I think I might have heard of this, but maybe in passing. So it does sound very interesting, actually. See, I'm learning too.
Of course. There are so many tools out there. It's impossible to know them all. Right. You did mention Git. I'm a very avid user of Git. I have my own personal installation. I have it running in Docker in one of my systems at home. Mm-hmm. I do mirror over 300 repositories from GitHub, just in case GitHub dies, of course, because that's something that happens. But one of the ways that you can use it in the enterprise is by having it running in your infrastructure, just as a backup of the stuff that you have in GitHub, for example, of your projects that you're developing. And you can keep that synchronizing immediately. Like every now and then, it will pull the latest version from the repository so that you always have the code available. And not just the code, it will actually replicate the list of commits like if it was the main repository, and you can use it as a backup for your development. This is especially true and useful if you're a development company and you have lots of people working on Git. So you just deploy Git on a different system and you point it to your usual repositories, and it will take care of keeping everything in sync. It's a very good
tool. That's a very good idea, actually.
One of the things that Git does not support is gist files, just one single file repository. And those tend to be very useful for storing configurations. Using a single file as a repository is something that you can do in GitHub through gists. And Git has that as a feature request, and it hasn't been implemented yet. And it's something that I really would love to see in the product.
Wow, yeah, I hope somebody does that. If anyone listening is a developer and wants to help out, maybe see if you could do that. So that's a very good point. Have something offline or not, something to sync it to. My process is way more complicated. I should probably look at that, because I'm literally just having a bash script run by cron doing a tar of like all my repositories, and then using a utility to transfer them to an offsite backup thing, and it does it regularly. But I think this is probably a way better solution than that. So not to knock my solution, it does work, but I think if I was going to do it again, I probably wouldn't do it that way, honestly. So the next in the chain here is coming from a previous episode where we talked about a golden image, basically a starting image that is going to have some defaults in it that are, safer defaults. For example, SSH configs, there could be some things in there that you want to disable. There's all kinds of things that you could put in an image that you could use as a deployment image that I won't get into because we have a whole episode about that. But one of the tools that I like is Packer for this purpose. Now, several of the tools are actually made by the same company. Packer, its job is to create an image, okay? So the alternative way you could do this, and I've seen it done this way, and I don't like it done this way personally, is when someone just has a VM that exists as the VM that they just constantly take images of to serve as an updated deployment image. Problem is, if something got into that server, then what got in there would be in every image. Then that's a problem. Now, if you leave something running, obviously this could be a problem. But what I like about Packer is by code, you can define what the image is like and what it, and it supports, you know, the usual suspects like your hypervisor solutions and all these. So you could create a template or an image depending on what your platform decides to call it, because the lingo is different with the defaults. And you can programmatically, like infrastructure as code style, define the image, and you could put your defaults in there. And at that point, you won't really care about deleting your image and then creating a new one, because you just run the scripts for Packer. And this is why it kind of piggybacks off of Git, because if you were to lose your Packer configs, especially if you've, you know, spent some time developing these over years, that's going to suck, because you have to recreate them again, and that's a lot of work. And if you have something in version control like Git or a Git server, then you could pull that config back down, and you can, of course, get your images recreated pretty easily, because that's what Packer allows you to do. So that's the first step in a series of additional selections I'm going to give you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, infrastructure as code, well, it's that's the foundation block for DevOps. And that's the way that IT admins should be doing stuff today. And it goes back to the pets and the cattle systems.
Right.
Today, you shouldn't be having too many pet systems. They should be more like cattle, so that you can deploy them anywhere and as many instances as you need. And the basis to do that properly is having scripts to create stuff. And Packer is part of that. Looking at infrastructure as code is part of that.
And, you know, I love installing Linux. I do it all the time, especially when I make videos and things. But if I'm in a pinch, I don't want to manually set up an operating system of any kind, right? So that's especially important with infrastructure as code, because it's saving you from doing that. It's either like you spend several hours just tweaking your CentOS or Red Hat, whatever you're using. You could do that. It takes hours, or you could just, you know, run a script and just go grab coffee and come back and your image is ready, which is always better. Yeah. Also saves you from human error, because what if, you know, you've, even though you've done this 100 times manually creating servers, hopefully you don't, but if you do, you can totally forget one of those steps that's even in one of the policies at your company that you're required to follow. We're human, right? So you might be tired, maybe forget that one thing, and that one thing could lead to a bigger thing. But if you script it, then, you know, maybe you're better protected from that situation. You're protected from yourself, I guess you could say.
Yeah, and it's reproducible, which is also a plus.
So, all right, so you have an image. That's awesome. You could use that image to deploy a server, and that's really cool. But you really should automate the deployment of a server as well. And the next one in the chain is Terraform. And Terraform, if you haven't, I think a lot of people in the audience has probably heard of Terraform. Packer is probably 50-50, even people that use Terraform, even though they're made by the same company, might not be aware of Packer, but I think a lot of people are aware of Terraform. But just in case you're not, it allows you to create a server or servers, plural, depending if you have more than one. And what Terraform can do is it, well, you need an image, right? Because you're just going to say, you know, spin up a CentOS server, but you need to give it an image. But the image that you give it could be the very same that you created with Packer. So Packer creates the image. Now the image exists. And then it's Terraform's job to make infrastructure exist. And it's going to use an image that you've created to do that. So then Terraform, it just fits in so well. I mean, yeah, it's made by the same company, but it's such a great process. You have, you know, your image is created, then you have a thing that makes that, take that image and actually creates actual instances with that image.
Yeah, it's part of the project. It's part of the workflow. It really changes the way that you look at systems and systems deployment. And we're going to look into more system deployment tools and system configuration tools as well next. This all follows like a straight path. You start with the image, you deploy the image. Next, you're going to configure the image to your standards and to your liking and get it to a state that you want it to be.
Yep. And one thing, this is a personal opinion. I think a lot of people will agree with me, but some people will not. And that's okay, because, you know, we all have our way of doing things, right? So I love Terraform for making things exist. I don't like it as much for taking things that already exist and updating them. And Terraform can absolutely do that, right? So if you wanted to, I don't know, change a subnet or change a name, and there's all kinds of things that you could do. You could update your infrastructure as well. It saves the state and you can make changes. The problem, though, is some of those changes might require the entire server to be recreated. Now, hopefully you're in a stance where that doesn't bother you because, you know, your system is so great that you have like a load balancer, you have auto healing and auto scaling, all these things. But, you know, most of us don't have those things yet. We're still working on those in some companies. If you make a wrong move, though, you could delete a server. And there are ways around this. There are ways of synchronizing the state with Terraform. There's no shortage of articles out there that'll tell you how to do that. I prefer just to not use Terraform for managing things at all, unless I want to, you know, delete something. I like to only use it for creating things and then using something like Ansible, Chef, Puppet, SaltStack. There's a number of these configuration and management utilities and automation tools that do a really good job of taking a server that already exists and then making it into something else or maintaining it. So for example, with Ansible, which I know very well because I use it every day, you could have a role. You could have a role that's web server. You could have a role that's database server. And by assigning a server to a role, it becomes the thing that you've defined, assuming you have no syntax errors, of course. And if you want to make a change, for example, there's this package you want to make sure is on every server, you can use Ansible for that. I wouldn't use Terraform for that. I would use Ansible or one of the tools that's in the same category for maintaining and modifying existing instances. So in this chain, you have your configuration files and your scripts in Git. You have Packer to create your images. You have Terraform to take your images and create actual instances with those images. And then you have your configuration management utility to maintain those and keep the configs sane. And also what they do is they revert config files. If something isn't at spec or isn't as defined, one of these tools will just delete that config file or just replace it with the one that it's supposed to have. So there also is a, I don't want to call it a protection layer because it's kind of hit or miss, but there is a little bit of that because it will absolutely replace something if it's not at the correct state. So those things combined, I think, will give you a, not an entire disaster recovery plan, but a lot of, a big part of it, actually.
It will help with a very big part of it.
Oh, yeah.
You can think of Ansible, Chef, Puppet, whatever, as a desired state tool. You tell it how you want the server to be at, and then they'll take care of getting it into that state. For example, you mentioned defining it as a web server. Okay, they'll get the packages in there to make it a web server, and they'll get the basic configuration in there to make it a web server running with the configuration that you want it to be running at. Yep. And you can replicate that over dozens or hundreds of them. There is no limit there. So this scales very well. This goes into large deployments very well, and it's very widely used, specifically in those scenarios where it's no longer feasible to do it manually. So yeah, those are the tools of choice currently.
Now, one of my pet peeves, which I have a lot, I like to complain, which I've been realizing very recently. But one of my pet peeves is that, you know, beyond the fact that we have these security solutions that claim in the marketing to make your servers hack-proof, which is silly, you know, one of the things that I've run into personally, and I a lot actually, is I'll look for one of these solutions because there might be something that I want to do or want to automate, or I want some kind of, you know, security scanning to happen. And I look at the product, I demo it, I think it's pretty cool. And then, how do I go forward with this? I talk to sales, and the next thing you know, I have a statement of work for $60,000 to implement it, and it's going to require about 20 servers to be spun up. And I'm looking at it like, what? That's just really complicating things and also saturating the budget. No, thank you. But this is extremely common when it comes to security. That's a lot of people make money this way. And I'm not trying to throw shade on all security companies out there, because I'm sure there's a lot of them that do really great work and have really great products. I've just run into some that are not as great that I won't throw them under the bus here. But it's really refreshing when you can just download something for free that may not have all the features that those really expensive tools have, but you can still benefit from them. And the tool that I'm going to mention is Sysify Linus. Linus is the name of the tool, L-Y-N-I-S. It's by Sysify, C-I-S-O-F-Y. And you can download this in your distributions repositories, although I don't recommend that because you'll probably get an older version that's not going to know about, you know, newer problems. They have a repository that you can add. And what it'll allow you to do is scan your server for things that you might want to pay attention to and adjust. One thing, though, is that I use this a lot, this tool. I actually have it automated now, but there's a ton of things it's going to come back with. It's not uncommon to see like 40, 50, 100 different things it's going to recommend that you change. And it's not that you have to do everything it says, but each thing that it comes up with, there's a reason. There's maybe a policy or a certification element like SOC 2 related or whatnot that inspired them to mention this. But you look through the list and see what's relevant. So, for example, they might complain if you don't have a message in SSH when you log into a server. It's supposed to show a message that says, you know, only connect to the server if you're authorized. The fate of the world depends on you not connecting to the server. And if you do connect to this server, you will create bad karma. Okay, it doesn't say that, but it does say, you know, only authorized.
Worthy of my favorite.
And of course, you know, if you are an outside attacker, you see this message all the time and you bypass it. You don't care. It's not going to stop anybody, but it does satisfy legal requirements, policy requirements, maybe in, I don't know, depending on where you are geographically, there's something to be said about, you know, if it goes to court that, you know, you have a clear policy that's shown and you know, communicated when someone tries to connect. It'll mention that, even though it's not going to really impact security all that much, but they will mention like vulnerabilities and really bad things as well. So I recommend checking that out. It is free. They do have like an enterprise version that I pay for. It's not $20,000 or $60,000 of the statement of work. It was, I forgot what it was. It's just basically they give you a dashboard if you just want a place to put all of your results in one area. But honestly, for the longest time, I was just running it in cron and exporting it in a text file. So, I mean, you could totally bypass that altogether. And I'm sure there's other tools like this. I was just really excited with Linus when I found out about it, because I found out about it right after I was engaging with a company for the company I was working for at the time to implement a security tool that did a lot of the same things. And the price tag was not something management was going to approve at all, which does happen. But I think management, depending on the mindset, you know, there is a mindset of free is bad that some companies have, but assuming yours don't have, doesn't have that mindset, just download it and run it. If nothing else, it gives you something that you can use tangibly to kind of get an idea where your security might be. It's not going to get to tell you about everything, especially what we mentioned about last podcast, but it is something to benefit from. And I think it's something to try out. Just again, I wouldn't recommend using the one in the distributions repositories because it's probably going to be out of date. Just look at their community repository and get a newer version installed. That would be a good idea.
There is one in that vein where it doesn't scan for vulnerabilities, but it does scan for state changes, for stuff that changed in your system, called Tripwire. I've used it before. Yep. Few years back, I don't know in what state it is currently, but I've used it for that. It will alert you for files that get updated, which is very useful when your machine is getting rootkitted or something like that. So it will tell you what files changed. And it provides some interesting reports. If your system does change often, then it will become meaningless because the reports will just give you some random noise. Right. But it is a tool that's interesting for systems that are not supposed to be changing, and you will get an alert if something changes.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing is not to put it on your WordPress server because you'll be notified every hour.
For example.
Yeah.
But you did cast some shade on companies that are selling security stuff before, and I cannot let that pass, obviously. I do work for TechScare. We are not one of those companies that you mentioned, obviously. So, again, I could not let that pass.
Oh, no, I wouldn't want you to. And, you know, TechScare offers multiple different things, I feel like TuxCare is in a different world because I've never seen a claim anywhere that it makes anything bulletproof. It's like pretty matter of fact, this solution does X, this solution does Y. And They don't say X is bulletproof. There's, you know, your basic, your live patching. It does live patching. That's what it does. And that's it. It's simple. And I love that about it. But the companies I'm talking about, they're the ones that have like one product. Their name is the same. You guys have the same name at one point as your main product. But I just really want to put these other ones in a category. And I'm having a hard time doing that because they're not the same, but it's kind of hard to really give you guys something to watch out for without, you know, angering a company out there and having them come after us. But just be careful, right? Just
what you mentioned there about one single product requiring like 20 different servers, that is something that happens a lot. It happens a lot, especially in systems like SIEM systems, where they're looking for intrusions and collecting logs from all your servers and all of that. They'll ask for a server just for doing the log collection, and then another one just for doing the analysis, and another for doing the reporting, and so on. When you look at the total bill there, you're buying like 20 new servers, like you just mentioned, just to support that solution.
That's probably the disqualifier, because I'm not aware of anything at TuxCare other than running like one ePortal server, which is optional, that you'd ever have to run. If you have to run a bunch of servers, but you know, there's look at other solutions before you go along with it. Maybe that's as simple as we can get it.
Yeah, probably. But again, I don't want to cast any shade on anybody.
Yeah.
We have the episode running a bit long. This is a very interesting topic, and there are a couple of tools that I would like to mention. Not for actual server deployments, but to dealing with the aftermath of a breach. There you actually found the system that has been attacked, and you managed to isolate whatever was causing the attack, and you managed to find the program that caused this. One good software that you can use to take a look at the code and see how it works and all of that, of course, assuming that you have the knowledge to actually look at source code, is IdaPro. It's a disassembler. It actually lets you look at the code in assembly format, but it will provide you with some comments and code decorations and all of that to help you understand the code and the code flow through the program. If you have the know-how on how to do this, or if you have somebody on your team that knows how to do this, say your star program or something like that, looking at the code of one of these tools will help you understand, for example, how they got into the network. It might give you some interesting information into how they access the network and what you should be closing at the firewall level, or what vulnerability they abused or something like that. So looking at the source code, if you have the know-how on how to do that, it can really help on this type of events. And at a more basic level, also for dealing with the aftermath of something like this, tools like S-Trace and F-Trace that let you trace the program execution flow as it's running are also very useful for this. Again, it depends on the level of knowledge that you have, on the technical skills of your team and all of that. This is not something that the basic sysadmin will ever have to know by himself. But it does help to have somebody on the team with some knowledge around these tools and how to use them and all of that. Because in these situations, it can be very handy.
Yep. Now, yeah, you're right. The episode is getting a little long, so I definitely want to mention this, though, because this is something that I was kind of building up for, and that is automatic updates, which could be live patching or just unattended upgrades. There's a difference here. At the lowest level and for free, you can run something like DNF Automatic on your Red Hat family systems. And then there's also the unattended upgrades on Debian and Ubuntu. Ubuntu has three machines for free with their Advantage program that you can get live patching for. Now, the difference with unattended upgrades is, it's just like it sounds. It's just going to install the updated packages for you, which you have to also understand, depending on your distribution, that might restart services when you do this. So you may or may not want to do this during production hours. I would say unattended upgrades, or the equivalent, whatever your distro names it, is like the lowest level, the least you could do. And you can configure it not to restart services. You just have to know that it can do that. Live patching.
Don't restart services, it's important to note that the one that you're running is still not updated. So you're still running the vulnerable code until you do restart it.
I'm so glad you brought that up. That is absolutely correct. So, and that's another reason to just say this is a very minimum thing that you can do, the least you could do. Live patching is one of these things that's like science fiction to me at first when I first heard of it, and then until I actually saw it happen and believed it, because I had to see this. Because longtime Linux administrators, you restart a server when the kernel gets updated, because that's the brain, right? Live patching came in later on. It's actually still kind of new, even though it's been out for a lot of years. It's still kind of making its rounds. is the idea of actually putting a patch into the kernel that's running, so that way you don't have to actually reboot it. And depending on the solution, it might actually go beyond that. Now, I'm going to talk not as an employee of TuxCare, because I'm not one. I actually don't work for TuxCare. And even though you do, I'm going to take this on my, or at least part of this on myself, because I run kernel care on the servers that I manage. And I chose to do this because for me personally, it was the best fit. And the reason for that is because the other solutions for live patching are also great. Like Ubuntu's is great. You know, the other distributions, they have their own. But the problem I run into there is it's very common that someone is a mixed shop when it comes to a Linux distribution. Even somebody who's all in on Debian, for example, might have that one SUSE server or some other distribution running here and there. And that could hypothetically mean, at least in my case, because I also run different distributions, I could be paying multiple companies for the live patching thing. And that's just not something that I wanted to do. And I like TuxCare because of many reasons, but one of the main reasons for me is it supports a ridiculous number of distributions out there, and all the enterprise ones, like pretty much everything you can think of, your Debians and Ubuntu's. So I have everything under one umbrella, and it does the live patching. And depending on if you have, Kernel Care Plus, you could also do the shared libraries. And that's also a game changer because, at least as far as I remember, I don't think Ubuntu's or Red Hat solution will do that. You could probably correct me if I'm wrong on that.
No, they don't. They are only for their own specific distribution. They do not support others.
Right. So I use it, and that's the reason I use it. Disclaimer, TuxCare has been and is a sponsor of the YouTube channel, but I agreed to have them on because I legitimately use their service, and that's why I do it. I wanted to mention it not as a plug for your employer, but just as an aside. It's definitely something that I recommend that you look at and compare against other solutions, because I think you'll probably come to the same conclusion that I came to.
Yeah, absolutely. When I first joined the company, I came with the background of working as a sysadmin for many years and doing things the old way, which was, like you said, updating a system and then rebooting a system to make sure that the new code got picked up and everything worked fine with the new code. The first time I was introduced to live patching, it was an eye-opener. Things could be done differently and much better and with no disruption at all. And again, I wish I had that before. I really did. Yeah.
That's also how I felt about it, too. I just never would have thought we'd still be rebooting our servers and even our laptops or desktops, nowadays. And it's just like crazy to me. I thought we would have, and we do have a better solution. It's just that it takes a while for some of these things to catch on. And thankfully it seems like that's happening now, which is great. But I just kind of found myself like, why am I saving all my work on my computer and this rebooting it? And still, like, this isn't 1995. Come on.
Yeah. In IT, we're very quick to pick up new technology, but changing habits, boy, does this take too long?
That's a lot. The last thing I'm going to mention on my side is just another plug for either YubiKey or something like it. We have a whole episode about 2FA. I'm not going to even approach the topic because that's a recent episode. It was just a couple of episodes ago. But another thing that I've learned recently, and this is just a personal opinion, but I think a lot of people will agree, because there's so many of these different keys and competitors to YubiKey. I don't really care what you use as long as you have some kind of 2FA solution. But I recommend looking at the FIDO Alliance site, and they have a listing of the keys that are in compliance and are audited and part of that program. So before you consider a key of some kind, it might just be a good idea to go to the FIDO Alliance website, even if that's not something that you're using, depending on which of the 2FA technologies you're using. I think it's probably a better judge of character than just something you see randomly on Amazon that just claims to be secure, but nobody's ever heard of before. So, definitely look at that.
And the maker will probably no longer exist 1 week from the day that you buy it. So, yeah.
Well, the device might not even work a week after you buy it.
Yeah.
It just might not be registered by the bus.
For example.
It might not even work. But I think 2FA, at least for me, is more trustworthy when I know it's coming from something that's been audited and checked rather than just somebody making a claim. Because just like everything else, you have a solution like 2FA, it's great. But if implemented poorly or designed poorly, it could basically be the same as if you just, you know, don't have it at all. So keep that in mind as you implement 2FA. Check out our previous episode on that to learn more about that. I didn't mention the FIDO Alliance site on that episode, which is why I wanted to give it a plug in this episode.
Yeah, sure. And again, we're running a bit long on this one. Apologies for that, everybody. We promise to keep this in control for the next ones, but the topic was just too broad and we could continue like for the rest of the next hour and the one after that.
Yeah, and let us know what your preference is. I mean, we could try harder if the preference is shorter episodes. My theory is that people are more forgiving about security podcasts than they are others, but I'll let the comments from the people judge that.
Yeah. And also, how technical do you want us to get into this stuff? Mm-hmm. Because we could look into topics like this one at a more technical level, which is a bit harder to get across on the podcast, or we can just keep it high level like we've been doing it so far, where we don't actually provide code or samples or anything like that, but we do give you an overview of what's out there so that you have a more informed decision when it comes time to do so.
Yeah, I agree. I'd like to know that as well. So definitely write in and let us know, and we'll look at that. And, you know, I think at this stage in our podcast, it's a great idea just to kind of, you know, re-engage with the audience and see how we're doing and what we can change, what we can do. We're 30 episodes in now, so we're not, this isn't a new podcast. This is a veteran at this point almost.
Or even if you're interested in us doing it live one day.
Yep. And that's something I definitely want us to get into at some point as well. Yep, that'll be great. So,
can promise there won't be a cat in the background at that point, but yeah, it can.
Or a lawnmower or something. You know how it goes. I mean, working from home, I think people are way more understanding than they used to be. So,
yeah, absolutely. Okay.
So that is the episode then. And there's a lot more. There's more tools. Like you said, we can go over more. And maybe we will do a follow-up at some point in the future.
Yeah. And again, these are tools that are supposed to save you time, to help you do stuff, to get things done faster and more reliably. There are tons of other tools out there. Every other day you get new tools that you can use. These are the ones that we know are reliable, that we've either used ourselves or that we have pretty good information about. And we do know that they are effective. So yeah, that's why we mentioned them.
And I'm going to underscore the fact that you should absolutely let your management team know before you run any of these things, just to make sure that you keep them in the loop, which is always important. So again, keep that in mind. And with that said, I'll go ahead and end the episode right here, because like you said, we went over, we're passionate. What can we say? But this is our episode on tools, and who knows, maybe there's going to be another one. So I appreciate you guys watching, listening, digesting, and we'll see you again very soon.
Thanks, everybody. Do not run the Ansible scripts on production. Do run them in the lab first. And until the next episode.
See ya.
Bye.